From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as a Senate committee approves the nomination of Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary, we get the pro.
What we've had is a status quo kind of approach to education policy, and I think this president and this secretary designate, who come from outside the norm, are here to shake things up.
And the con.
She has worked in a fashion that demonstrates that she is not committed to public education, which is a concern.
The West Michigan group Samaritas has resettled refugees in our state for over 60 years. Today, they cope with the president's ban on refugees.
You know, I wish we had extreme vetting of our people running for public office as much as we do for refugees, and maybe we wouldn't be here in the first place.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. West Michigan billionaire and political donor Betsy DeVos is up for confirmation as the new Secretary of Education today. We'll hear from a supporter and a critic later in the hour. But first, as we've seen at airports, college campuses, and city centers across the nation, President Donald Trump's executive order on refugees and immigrants has angered quite a few people. But what are Michigan residents just going about their day thinking about all of this? Stateside's Lindsay Scullin hit the streets today to talk with people.
I don't think it's a bad thing. You know, they can vend them a little bit better and make sure that who they are is who they say they are.
I think it's great. He needs to protect this country. They have no right to be here unless we allow them to be. And we're Americans. They are not. They're not up to taking our rights nor our tax dollars. So I support him 100%.
I think that it's really scary. I'm horrified. I think it leads some of my friends to feel so pressured that they're about to explode, really. And the concern, and then I see a lot of smoothing things over from my conservative friends trying to grasp this, and they know it's wrong too.
I'm an immigrant myself, so I waited 10 years to get in. I think we should secure our borders, and that's it. That's what I believe in.
I don't think he's hurting anybody. I don't think it's a Muslim ban like everybody claims it is. The top five Muslim countries aren't really affected by the Muslim ban, so I don't think it's really a bad thing.
I can understand wanting to come here and have a better life and all that, but we need to worry about our people having a better life first, because we have too many people in our own country that are starving, homeless, and have our own issues that we need to deal with first. And we've always put ourselves second compared to everybody else. We think we need to save everybody else and help everybody else.
In my opinion, I think things are being blown out of proportion. I think he's just trying to keep things balanced and make sure that whoever comes in from anywhere is good to go. I don't think it's unreasonable, because he's only asking for 3 months. And that's just my point of view.
The White House continues to insist the president's executive orders on immigrants and refugees will make America safer. The West Michigan group Samaritas begs to differ. Samaritas is the largest resettler of refugees in Michigan and the fourth biggest in the nation. Chris Kavanaugh is the Refugee Resettlement Program Director for Samaritas. Chris, as we know, the president's executive orders suspends all refugee admission for 120 days and bars all Syrian refugees indefinitely, and, as we know, imposes severe restrictions on travelers from those seven Muslim-majority countries. Does this make us safer?
I would argue that it does not. In fact, it's certainly something that is going to be discussed for a long time, and it's been separating families that we've been working with. And unfortunately, it's been a real detriment to some very vulnerable people. And so how that makes us safer, I guess I'm not exactly sure.
Well, and as you work with refugees, what have you come to know about these people coming to Michigan looking for a new home?
So I've been working with refugees for 16 years now. And I found them to be some of the most resilient, generous, and hardworking people that have come from atrocities that you and I could never imagine. And yet they come here with hope for a better life and a commitment to, you know, working hard to contribute to our economy and our country. And so we've seen that with, you know, interpreters that have worked with our troops overseas and fought alongside of them and in some cases rescued them from from harm's way. And these are, you know, people that are kind of wrapped up in all of this right now.
How many refugees, Chris, is Samaritas working with, preparing to relocate here to the U.S.?
Usually each year we resettle statewide about anywhere from 900 to 1,200 refugee individuals. So that's a mix of individual cases and family cases. That count includes adults and children. And so we resettle in Southeast Michigan and Metro Detroit, here in Grand Rapids where I'm located, and Battle Creek and Kalamazoo in Southwest Michigan.
And so what was the immediate effect of Friday's orders? What kind of weekend did you have?
Well, the order's been kind of a bulldozer to our programs here, and certainly to the refugees that are here, and we're having family members reunite with them or scheduled to, you know, reunify with them even this week and next week. So, for example, I have one case of a lady refugee from Burma who we resettled 3 years ago, has been separated from her daughter who's still in Burma for, you know, they haven't seen each other for 5 or 6 years now. They're of the Christian, persecuted Christian minority. And so this refugee here in Southwest Michigan had applied for her daughter to come, had gone through all the waiting, all the steps, all the vetting, and it's been years. And finally, her daughter was approved to come and scheduled to travel in January. Unfortunately, the daughter got sick at the time of the travel and had to reschedule the flight for next week. And now, unfortunately, this mother who's been waiting to reunite with her daughter for years, and now her daughter, who's, you know, the persecuted minority that this order was supposedly supposed to protect, is now caught up in this, and for at least 120 days won't be able to reunite with her mother. So it's, you know, some heart-wrenching stories that we've been hearing.
And I've seen statements from the White House team saying, hey, everybody, settle down. It's 120 days, although for Syrians, it's an indefinite ban.
That's correct. So in West Michigan, it has been primarily Christian refugees. The biggest groups that we've had in numbers have been from Burma and the Congo. And these groups are primarily of various Christian denominations. So Catholic, Seventh-day Adventist, Pentecostal, Baptist, you know, you name it. And so really the order, which was supposed to, you know, kind of help those people have a priority, are all, you know, stuck in limbo now. So, and most of them were folks that were going to be reuniting with family members that are already here.
But at least there's that 120-day thing to look forward to. Are you worried that that is going to move, that's going to change?
Well, I certainly have my suspicions that of will they even reopen the program after 120 days? You know, there's, you know, I certainly have my worries that that won't be the case. And to make things even more complicated for these refugees that are waiting, they're subject to security clearances and medical clearances, and they all have expiration dates on them. So if any of these during this 4-month period, if their security clearances or medical clearances expire, all of those things have to be redone. So we could be looking at some cases being, even after the 4 months, it could be 6 months or even years before they go through all that processing again. Not to mention whatever additional extreme vetting measures will be imposed on them after, you know, this 120-day period.
Chris, I found myself wondering just what happens when someone's travel date approaches, they're ready to head to their new home in Michigan and give up their spot in the resettlement camps. What does that mean when they do that? And now the door is closed for, in some cases, 120 days, in some cases, indefinitely if you're from Syria. What does that mean about giving up your spot in the resettlement camps?
Well, it's really devastating and heartbreaking. I mean, some of the families, you know, have given up what little they did have in the refugee camp because they were scheduled to travel. And yeah, honestly, I don't even know exactly what happens to those refugees. You know, they either have to go back to the camp or, you know, even worst case scenario, they would have to go back to their home country where things are in total upheaval and in ruins. So yeah, we don't know if those folks that were scheduled, if we'll ever see them here in the U.S.
Chris, are you directly helping any potential refugees with life-threatening medical problems? I'm wondering what this ban could mean for those people.
Yeah, certainly over the last few years, the U.S. has prioritized certain refugees that do have life-threatening medical conditions. And in a place like Grand Rapids, where, you know, the healthcare community is advanced and top-notch in the country, this has certainly been a place where the federal government has identified that we can work with those kinds of cases here in West Michigan. And yeah, so for sure, we won't be seeing them. They won't get the care that they need in the refugee camps. We know that. And so, yeah, I mean, people's lives are at stake here.
The president's executive order allows the secretaries of state and homeland security to admit people as refugees on a case-by-case basis, quote, in the national interest. Are you pursuing or planning to pursue appeals? I mean, what are your options?
Well, we do work with our national partners, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services and Episcopal Migration Ministries. They have some advocacy folks on the ground that are trying to get us information about what that means, how we can access that. At this point, we don't have any information really about how refugees can, you know, apply for that.
And for people listening to us talk who do not support what the president has done, what are you telling people to do, people who care? What are the best actions for them to take, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we saw a lot of it over the weekend with people kind of spontaneously getting out and marching and going to the airports and protesting.
But that has not appeared to change any hearts and minds in the White House.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I knew what it would take to change hearts and minds in the White House. You know, I wish we had extreme vetting of our people running for public office as much as we do for refugees, and maybe we wouldn't be here in the first place.
Chris Kavanaugh is the Refugee Resettlement Program Director for the West Michigan Group, Samaritas. Chris, thank you so much for taking our questions.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump's travel ban has left universities and colleges scrambling to figure out the implications of barring people from seven mostly Muslim countries from entering this country. International faculty and students have been stranded abroad or left unsure about whether or not they can travel. Subin Nurkuli is in that position right now. She's working on her PhD, and she's a grad assistant in the Department of Writing, Rhetoric, and American Cultures at Michigan State University. She is Somali with Australian citizenship. Subin, it's good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote a public post on Facebook basically outlining your response to President Trump's restrictions. What were you trying to say in that post?
Well, essentially, I think I was trying to highlight the ramifications of this executive order on many individuals from these populations, these seven banned countries. I think people are aware of the realities of those who are just coming into the country as refugees or asylum seekers. But what about those of us who have been here for a really long time, who are either students, who are permanent residents, who are just unsure of what state we're in now the next time we leave the country.
Now, you are an Australian citizen, so how do you feel that the president's actions will affect you and the work you do?
You know, I have been struggling with that. I think the benefit of being an Australian national is that I have a country that isn't in turmoil to return to. So I'm safe. I'm privileged to have this citizenship. But at the same time, as a PhD student here in America and a permanent resident with family members, my son and husband, who are American citizens, I have a conference in Spain in June, for example. And if things stay the way that they are, my traveling there, what happens upon return, you know?
Now, the order is for 120 days, at least at this point. Are you concerned that that's not going to, he's not going to stick to that?
I'm just really not sure what to assume. The fact that this is even involving me is already seems ludicrous, as it is.
What are you hearing among faculty and students at Michigan State? I'm sure people are talking a lot about it. What are they saying?
To be honest, within my department, I've garnered a lot of support. I know that people who are my grad chair said that she would support me in any way I needed and would be there for me, even if legal action was needed to be taken. So I think the support is there, but I think there's also this, it's an understanding of the fact that this is affecting researchers and wide-reaching in regards to who this impacts.
And your research involves traveling to Africa and working in Africa, right?
Right. So even now, I have stamps in my passport. I traveled to Somalia in 2015, you know, and I've been questioned at the border before, but I wonder what that's going to look like now.
Do you feel like you might have to leave the United States? Do you worry about that you might have to take your work and your talents elsewhere?
I hope it doesn't get to that point. I really do. I've been in Michigan for 11 years. Lansing is my home. It's my community. I have support from even council members who are at city council last night. One of my representatives, Kathy Dunbar, read my statement to make Lansing a sanctuary city. So I have so much support here. I would love to continue working and living here, but we'll have to see.
How are you feeling since all of this came down on Friday?
I'm surprised. You know, I want to say I didn't think it would impact me, but to be honest, I'm a black woman. I'm from the Somalia. I knew this administration would have an impact on my livelihood in some capacity, whether it be through my background or my daily experience. But this is just not something I had anticipated occurring.
Michigan State University graduate student Subhan Noor Cooley, who I'm sure is echoing the feelings of many in the academic communities across the country. Subhan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions this morning voted 12-11 to allow the full Senate to vote on Betsy DeVos as the nation's next Secretary of Education. Her qualifications to be the nation's top education official came under harsh criticism from Democrats through the nomination process. Here now to talk about DeVos and her recent Senate hearing is Gary Neyert. He's executive director of the Great Lakes Education Project. It's an organization founded and supported by DeVos and her husband. It works for greater support and expansion of charter schools. He spoke with Stateside's Lester Graham.
So I want to talk about the DeVos Senate hearing. Some of the Democrats on the Senate grilled Betsy DeVos and felt she either would not or could not answer their questions. I want to play a question from Senator Tim Kaine on accountability for public and private schools receiving federal money.
If confirmed, will you insist upon that equal accountability in any K-12 school or educational program that receives federal funding, whether public, public charter, or private?
I support accountability.
Equal accountability for all schools that receive federal funding.
I support accountability.
Okay, is that a yes or no?
I support accountability.
Do you not want to answer my question?
I support accountability.
Okay, let me ask you this. I think all schools that receive taxpayer funding should be equally accountable. Do you agree with me or not?
Well, they don't. They're not today.
But I think they should. Do you agree with me or not?
Well, no, because...
You don't agree with me. Let me move to my next question.
All right, a little argumentative there. Gary Neyert, why shouldn't all schools receive federal money be equally accountable?
Well, I think that was an excellent exchange, except it illustrated Senator Kaine's desire to, you know, kind of harass Ms. DeVos a little bit. But what she was trying to get at is we really don't have uniform application of accountability today. What we have in Michigan, for example, is we have a higher level of accountability for charter public schools than we do traditional public schools. And when I say that, I mean in state law we have a statute that requires the mandatory closure of charter schools if they reach a certain level of poor performance. And there's no such provision for traditional public schools.
Well, so, I mean, we're talking about closing 38 public schools right now because...
Yes, we are. I'm saying that there is a statute that requires it for charters. And then the new DPS law that requires closure or restructuring, this is the very first instance where a traditional public school even has the chance of being closed because of poor academic performance. And that was a law that GLEP strongly pushed for because we want uniform application. So she was trying to have a discussion. Senator Kaine was not interested in an interchange. He was interested in a gotcha. And I think they're also looking to expand the discussion to non-public schools, which is just not a topic that they had really gotten into. So I don't think she was given a chance by many of the Democratic senators to try to explain her answers That's unfortunate. But, you know, should there be uniform application of tough accountability? There should be. There hasn't been. And that's what we have pushed here in Michigan.
I want to note for our listeners, when Gary says GLEP, he means Great Lakes Education Project, the group he's with. Some of the senators were critical of Betsy DeVos because she's had no experience as an educator or an administrator in a school. How valid is that criticism?
The criticism is based on the fact that she's not part of the traditional education establishment and that she's an outsider from that perspective, something that President Trump has been interested in bringing into his cabinet. And we have had professional educators at the helm of American education policy for decades, and our scores continue to fall and our competitiveness continues to wane compared to our international competitors. So what we've had is a status quo kind of approach to education policy. And I think this president and this secretary designate, who come from outside the norm, are here to shake things up. That's a scary proposition for the historic defenders of the status quo, who I like to call the edublob.
Well, we require people to be qualified, have experience for far lesser roles than Secretary of Education. Where do you draw the line between having that proper background and just bringing in an outsider's perspective for the sake of being an outsider?
Well, we said outside the education establishment. She's been involved in education policy for 30 years. So to say she's not, you know, she's not from the traditional education pedigree in terms of her background, but she has been an education policy advocate for 30 years. She mentors students in Grand Rapids Public Schools on a weekly basis. She's been personally involved with a number of schools. So it's not to say she has no background. She has a different background. Now, there are 5,000 professionals that work in the U.S. Department of Education, and the secretary is the manager and leader of the department. She's not the teacher in chief. She's not the school superintendent in chief. And if you were a teacher or a board member of a school out there in Michigan, you should be very refreshed that Betsy DeVos is likely to be the secretary, because she's not going to reach out from Washington and micromanage how a district operates, how a building operates, or how a classroom operates. And that's going to be a refreshing change from the recent past.
There are some of these larger discussions that educators are aware of. I'll use, for example, the thing that Senator Al Franken brought up, and that was about growth versus proficiency, and there was some discussion about that. But it appeared that she didn't have a basic understanding of the difference between growth, the student's growth, or meeting proficiency. Are those kinds of things something a Secretary of Education should be aware of or needs to get briefed on?
Again, I think the interrogation by Senator Franken was more about scoring political points than it was having legitimate policy discussion. And I know from my personal experience—
Do you think that's a policy discussion that she should have with someone?
I think it is a policy discussion that is happening, that she has been engaged in. We have measured students by proficiency almost entirely for the last 150 years. And Michigan's top to bottom ranking up until 2 years ago was based 100% on proficiency, which serves as nothing more than a proxy for poverty, and it's a bad measure of school performance. We are moving as a state and as a country to balance proficiency and growth, and the bill that GLEP supports in Michigan for an A to F system for the last 4 years that Betsy supports balances proficiency and growth. She understands it. We understand it. Her national advocacy group that she founded, American Federation for Children, their model legislation on school accountability balances proficiency and growth. That is the nature of the current debate. She's not going to debate whether it should be 48% proficiency and 52% growth. That's what all the states are deciding, how to balance it. But what she was trying to get at was acknowledge that we do look at proficiency and growth, and that's proper today, but that her goal is to look past the current debate on proficiency and growth and move our entire system to a competency-based education system where students move through the process not based on age and grade, but on their content mastery per subject. And so if a student can finish what they need for a high school diploma in 9 years, so be it. If it takes 14 years, so be it. most students will take 12 years. But what she wants to do is rewrite the educational playbook for America and get past this artificial kind of distinction of age and grade and what exactly you should learn by this date or this date or this date. That's where she wants to elevate the education discussion. She tried, perhaps inarticulately, to have that conversation with Senator Franken, and it didn't come off, obviously.
In a recent article from Politico magazine, it quotes both Dick and Betsy DeVos, who spoke at a meeting in 2001. They both indicated that there's no better way to rebuild families and communities than to have church and school and family much more tightly focused, and they said that this has been displaced by public schools. How much is that sentiment behind the efforts to get more kids and more state funding into private or charter schools?
I think that what the DeVoses have is a very strong, you know, religious faith, and I think that that is not something to be criticized. I think what we need in education broadly is more of an effort at increasing students' character development. I think there are many experts who would agree that we should focus on character development in our schools, especially given the demise of the discourse and the negativity that is occurring in society in general across the country. And do schools have a role in promoting character development for students? And I think what they would say is yes.
When you say character development, does that include religious training or?
Well, no, religious training is done best in the church, in the home, and in parochial schools.
Then what were they getting to about public schools getting in the way of Christianity, basically?
Well, I wasn't with the organization at the time, and I'm not even familiar with the speech that you're referring. So I don't know the context in which the comments were made, and I'm not
it
sure.
It was at an annual meeting called The Gathering.
Yeah, I believe, I mean, and I'm not sure, was it Betsy who said these things you're quoting or Dick? Because we certainly aren't going to, you know, attribute every comment that Dick DeVos might have made in the last
spoke at The Gathering, so let me ask you one question. It seems there's little doubt that Betsy DeVos will be confirmed. So what do you expect in the first year of her tenure as Secretary of Education?
Well, as the Secretary, as an appointee of the President, she serves at the President's desires and wills and for his policy agenda. And there have been two very clear policy goals that President Trump has made public during the campaign. One is that he would like to expand the use of school choice, especially creating additional opportunities for poor and minority students who are at risk, who don't have the means to either pick up and move to the suburbs or pay for private school tuition. That's certainly a policy agenda that Betsy DeVos believes strongly in, so they're in alignment on that. So I think you're going to see efforts to expand public school choice in America. The second item that he talked about was reducing the federal footprint on education and doing everything we can to remove some of the strings and mandates from Washington and leave decision-making and power to the states and the local districts. That's something that not only does she believe in, but it was included in the passage of the new federal education law, ESSA or ESSA. And what we need to do is make sure that that law that goes into effect this year is implemented in a manner that's consistent with the Congress that passed it, which was to reduce the federal involvement, send decision-making and power back to the states. Some of the career bureaucrats who wrote the guidelines to implement the law weren't perhaps as true to that mission as the Congress that passed the law. So I think you're going to see some back and forth on some of the rules and the implementation of the rules. President Trump has already announced a 60-day pause in implementing some of these new guidelines so that they can be reviewed to make sure that they are, in fact, reducing the federal influence on education and putting that, again, back to the states. So I think those are the two biggest items, those are the two that he's talked about on the campaign trail. And if he has other key agenda items for education, we should be hearing about those in the next, I would say, 2 or 3 months.
That's Gary Narrett. He is the executive director of Great Lakes Education Project. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Lester.
Up next, Betsy DeVos, fellow Calvin College alums who do not support her as education secretary. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gary Nyard of the Great Lakes Education Project just told us why he believes Betsy DeVos would be, in his words, a refreshing change as our Secretary of Education. Now to the other side, voices protesting her nomination. And these include students and alums of her alma mater, Calvin College. Thousands of them signed a letter opposing the confirmation of their fellow alumna for the top education post. Sarah Mosliner graduated from the private Christian school in 1996. Today, she's a professor at Central Michigan University in the religion program, and she wrote the letter protesting the DeVos nomination. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
What are your thoughts as you hear that the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions indeed approved the nomination?
It's not at all surprising. I know with these sorts of nominations that oftentimes the confirmation process is a rubber stamp. And in fact, as events have unfolded, it's been quite interesting to see all the forms of opposition that are coming from all sorts of places, here in West Michigan especially. And the part that I played in it was just a small part. Someone remarked to me at one point, you know, to have this much opposition and controversy around a nominee for Secretary of Education is just unprecedented. So the final vote is not surprising. However, the closeness is very much so.
Sarah, what was the case that you made against this nomination in your letter?
When I wrote the letter, it felt very boilerplate. It was a lot of the things that people had concerns about during her hearing. And I simply reiterated those and in the letter, which initially was just coming from myself. And they seemed to really hit a chord with a lot of people. So, you know, the same sort of issues that she is not properly qualified as someone who has never worked in education as a teacher or an administrator. She has worked in a fashion that demonstrates that she is not committed to public education, which is a concern when we know that 85% of students are in public education, you know, and especially her responses about federal oversight. There were a lot of things she was not aware of. So really just getting to issues of qualifications, which are concerns that have come from other quarters. And so they were not at all unique.
I think from many quarters, and I think many people were surprised that so many students and alums of this conservative Christian college signed the letter. Ultimately, how many signatures did the letter gain?
Officially, we ended up with 2,750. However, because this was very much my own initiative, which I never intended to become as big as it was, I simply didn't have the capacity to make sure everyone got on the letter. I did enlist three of my closest friends to do some work on it, and they worked diligently for 3 days, long, long hours. And despite our best efforts, we could not get everyone on the letter because we just, you know, hadn't planned on being able to deal with that volume.
So you were surprised by the response?
I was. I wasn't surprised that so many Calvin alumni wanted to sign a letter like this. I was surprised that it was a letter that I had crafted that initially started out with me sending it to friends who I went to college with and said, hey, why don't we sign this? If we get 50 signatures, that might say something, to something that just went far beyond anything I expected or was prepared for.
There's so many people from disparate backgrounds that were opposed to DeVos for Education Secretary, but she has cleared the committee, going to the full Senate. In a larger question, I just wonder what you see for our country when it seems that despite protests, despite people voicing opposition to things on the Trump agenda, it doesn't seem to matter. Do you worry about our country and that people will become disheartened?
I've been thinking about this a lot, as a lot of people have. And I've been having a lot of conversations with people who are expressing heartbreak. And yet, in the very moment, you see these amazing, wonderful things happening and people making their voices heard and having an impact.
But are they having an impact?
I think to look at something like her nomination, her confirmation as the only impact is a bit short-sighted. I mean, there are other impacts out there, and not just about this issue, but there are impacts to people showing up and protesting at airports right now. That sends a really important message to other countries, to people in our own country who are feeling a great deal of fear. And so even if on the official level, things don't seem to be going in a direction that make us feel confident about the current administration, our speaking up in protest does complicate things. And that is very important for us to be doing right now, that we can't be disheartened, that it's more important than ever that we share our opposition when we feel, when our conscience goes against these appointments, these orders that are coming out, that we make that known, because it's important that our neighbors know. It's important that other countries know. It's important that my fellow alumni know that Calvin College cannot be put in a box, that Calvin, as a lot of people know, which is something that people in the press have not been necessarily aware of, is that there's a great deal of political and religious diversity at this Christian college. And a lot of that is because of the education we got as students at Calvin College. And so it does have meaning beyond these official things that are happening. At the moment, I have turned my attention to what is happening locally, which is why I chose this particular issue to speak out on. And I think that if we focus too much on what's happening in the White House, we lose sight of the best ways to take care of those who are right next door to us.
Sarah Mosliner is a Calvin College alumna and a professor in the religion program at Central Michigan University. Sarah, thank you so much for spending time and talking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Tonight, Detroit Public Television will debut a new documentary about the U.S., Michigan, and the high rate of imprisonment and the high costs associated with it. Here's an example of some of the numbers.
Nationwide, 2.3 million people are penned up, more people behind bars than any country on earth. It's estimated that 1 in 8 men in the USA have been convicted of something. And the way it's going, 1 in 3 African-American men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. Remember the 1980s? How about mandatory minimums? Then came Bill Clinton, who, along with all those other politicians, prosecutors, sheriffs, and judges, decided to get tough on crime.
My privilege to sentence you to life in prison without parole.
Annually, it costs $80 billion to keep all those people in prison. Such a big operation, there's a name for it. Call it the PIC, the Prison Industrial Complex.
The documentary is called Pathways to Prison, a One Detroit Special Report. Stateside's Lester Graham recently sat down with a Detroit Historical Society member and the documentary's co-host, Marlo Stoudemire.
Marlo, this documentary looks at things such as the faulty education system, poverty and its impacts, and race. Let's start with education. How is it one of the pathways to prison?
Really, it starts as early as pre-K for some kids, really tying into suspension rates. And one of the things that we look at in the documentary is that when we start looking at stories with young people in their early school years, what happens is that whether it be kids being disciplined early, zero tolerance policies in terms of suspension, similar to what you would see in mandatory minimums, it starts this kind of pathway to young people being more likely to be in offenders, showing the correlation to how they're treated in schools, how they are interacting with teachers, the similar way that you would see in more of a policing type of state.
I want to confirm what you just said. You said there were a lot of suspensions for kids even before they get into kindergarten and preschool?
Yes. We're seeing a dramatic amount of kids being expelled and missing a lot of schools. And in the documentary, there's one young man over the course of a school year who misses up to 60 days of school through suspensions at a very early age, and they're tied to some level of his behavior. In some situations, some of these kids are being diagnosed with some type of either learning disability, attention deficit disorders, so young. But more importantly, the disproportionate amount of these kids who are African-American versus their counterparts in the suburban schools is really what's alarming and shocking for a lot of people.
Well, let's talk about race then. As we reported recently here, African Americans make up about 13% of the population in the U.S. They make up about 37% of the prison population. How does race become one of the pathways to prison?
Honestly, I mean, it starts literally with just looking at the numbers. I mean, looking at the difference between what happens in similar situations between what you'll see in urban communities or communities that are really impacted by poverty. And so, for example, 1 in 8 men in America have been convicted of something. But we're also learning that 1 in 3 African-American men will go to prison in their lifetime. And so just really looking at the data, and numbers don't lie. And just peeling the onion a little bit more, like if you come back to schools, and I'll give you a better anecdote, one school in Detroit that we looked at recorded 1,300 suspensions, right, during the school year, but their student body only accounts for 600 students in attendance. So you're talking about a little over maybe just 2 suspensions per child, and showing the impacts of that and understanding why, right? Why are these kids having behavior issues? Well, you start looking at sizes of classrooms, you start looking at the stress of being a student in the inner city alone. You look at cultural competency, where you have teachers who may be coming from different backgrounds, may not necessarily be able to relate to what these kids are going to. And I think that that's kind of the starting point. Then you start looking at other things that you talked about earlier, like poverty, and you start looking at some of the policies from the 80s and whatnot, and kind of being tough on crime. And then you just have a combination of conditions and communities, as well as policies, systems, and institutions who are kind of just tilted in the wrong direction, as far as I'm concerned.
There have been a lot of significant studies linking poverty to crime and fear of crime, living in fear of crime all the time, and prison. What does this new documentary reveal about that connection?
Well, really what it reveals is that it's a business in terms of locking people up, mass incarceration. There are people who profit and benefit from it. And there's really no scientific data that shows the more people you lock up, the lower crime rates go. There's really no correlation that these people that they target, right, are really a threat, as they say they are, to society. And more than anything, there's really nothing correctional about the corrections department. And so when you look at, for example, poverty as a gateway to prison, without money or being able to envision a future, a pathway to prison for some people is obvious. I mean, the child poverty rate has risen to 23% in the last 10 years. 63% of Americans say they don't have the savings to even cover a $500 emergency, which is some of the stuff that we talk about in the documentary. And really what we show is that, you know, kids aren't born bad. People aren't born bad. You have people that are literally reacting to the environment that they're in. And so for me, growing up in the city of Detroit and understanding that, you know, in my lifetime, I grew up knowing perfectly good kids, but these kids were impoverished, disenfranchised, and marginalized. And one day, maybe that kid made a mistake and he stole something. And then he gets given a disproportionate amount of jail time. And at that point, his mind is crumbling under the weight, right? His mental health deteriorates, right? They're probably medicating him. They're not correcting him. And then they release him back into an environment and tell him to survive. And so when you look at that, and you look at the fact that most of these people that it happens to, they look like me. I'm an African-American man, and I grew up in Detroit during the 80s when things just exploded. So that's just part of it. But more anecdotal, coming from a personal experience, we can go into statistics all day long, but we know that it's a problem.
Well, I've got some numbers here. Another part of the documentary concentrated on the Michigan numbers, and I want to play a little bit of that.
Michigan, where we have the DOC, the Department of Corrections. The DOC runs 31 prisons across the state. Back in 1973, we had less than 8,000 prisoners. Now we're at 42,000, and we spend $2 billion a year keeping them there. That's $1 of every $5 coming out of the state's general fund. What could you do with all that cash? You could send every Detroit public school student to Wayne State University, full ride for 3 years. That prison population has to come down. But how? In Lansing, they've been working on something called presumptive parole, or as some want to call it, safe and smart parole reform. That lets more prisoners out sooner, those who've overstayed their mandatory minimums and haven't caused too much trouble doing that time. Parole reform has bipartisan support, conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats together. They agree, but it's not clear sailing yet. Our governor seems to like it, but our attorney general doesn't. Neither do lots of prosecutors and county sheriffs, who say if more ex-cons hit the streets, crime goes up and their cash-strapped agencies will have way too big a workload.
Marlo, where do we seem to be heading with prison reform in Michigan?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you're speaking to this, whether you call it parole reform or citizen reentry. I think our legislature is trying to change some things, but I think little is happening. It's important for people to really take a look. I think that, you know, in order for us to really be committed, we have to provide opportunities to what Mike Duggan, and I like the language that the mayor says when he says returning citizens, right? What are the opportunities? How are we connecting them to opportunities for as far as job training programs? How are we helping to also rebuild their confidence and maybe address some of the mental issues that have? You know, I got a friend who's part of this documentary. His name is Shaka Singor. And Shaka talks about spending time in solitary confinement and what it does to you emotionally and mentally. So you're not only trying to bring people back into the community and find them jobs, but you're also talking about potentially damaged individuals. So I think that, you know, you're talking about a holistic approach. You know how they say mind, body, and spirit. It's really important that we not forget about the mental aspect of it, but make sure that there's opportunities. I mean, if there is a pipeline that consistently has this rotating or forever changing cycle of people coming in and going back out and coming back in, going back out, and there's nothing in between to stop that, you know, policy alone, I think, isn't going to do it. I think it has to be a collective and comprehensive approach where you have all layers working together. If you look back, and let's just talk about the elephant in the room, as far back as 1965, this whole mass incarceration boom and this tough on crime language and this coded language, whether it's Nixon, Reagan, or even most recently with the new president, I mean, who are they really talking about and who are they really protecting people from? So I think it's a combination of messaging, policy, but also opportunities with some balance of social service support to help people when they reenter.
The new documentary from Detroit Public Television's One Detroit Bureau is Pathways to Prison. It airs tonight at 8 o'clock. DPTV is one of Michigan Radio's Detroit Journalism Cooperative partners. Marlo Stoudemire is with the Detroit Historical Society, and along with Christy McDonald, co-hosts the documentary. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. And just remember that everybody has a story. Just take the time to listen.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Messmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.